far in our study, we've talked about being happy, having a positive attitude no matter what we're facing. That was our beginning lesson. And then we talked about being influential, making a difference in the world, like salt and light, two illustrations that were used. And then lesson three, we finished up Matthew chapter 5 on being righteous, having a righteousness that surpasses the Pharisees, not as much in duration as it does in depth. Our righteousness should come straight from the center of hearts of faith. That has brought us to Matthew chapter 6 and making sure that when we do all of these right things from the heart, that we are doing them for the right reasons. So, for instance, it's great to help people in need. I hope you found some opportunity this week to help somebody who did not have what they needed. But we need to make sure we're doing that to help people and to glorify God. And so it talks about not really sounding your horn to let everybody know you're about to be benevolent. The purpose should not be accolades, and it should not be sort of self-fulfillment. It's supposed to be about God and other people. The same is true of prayer. Prayers can have these meaningless repetitions to them, these chants to them, just because of how it sounds to the audience. Prayers can be offered as an act of hypocrisy, like the Pharisees who would kind of stand on the corner dressed in their perfect outfits, reciting these popular phrases, and yet inside there was no faith in them. And so what Jesus is talking about here is be really, really sincere in your prayer life. Make sure it is coming from the right place. It reminded me of a lesson we did last month on praying in the Spirit. When you talk to God, take love, take joy, take peace, take patience and kindness and gentleness. Capture those things in your heart and then take them before God, and that's your motivation. Prayer is not about other people hearing us and being impressed by us, and it's certainly not about impressing God. It's just about taking what's in our heart and pouring it out before Him. So to help us with that, Jesus gives us what we commonly call the Lord's Prayer. It's in Matthew chapter 6, verses 9 through 13. And on your material, what I have here for you is, give your idea of what you believe Jesus is asking us to do in our prayer lives. So for instance, in verses 9 and 10, I answered this already. Verses 9 and 10 say this, pray then in this way, our Father who is in heaven, hallowed be your name, your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. What is Jesus teaching us about sincere prayer in those two verses?
We have to acknowledge that God is holy and God is righteous and He's awesome.
All right, God is holy, God is righteous, God is awesome. You notice how that first phrase tells you who God is and where God is and how worthy God is. He is our Father, He is in heaven, hallowed be His name. Now this phrase, thy kingdom come, is really worth a whole quarter's worth of study. Perhaps He was saying the church was about to be established, or perhaps He was talking about the rule of Jesus that would live in our hearts, and we're always praying for that. But either way, this statement is an acknowledgement of the power of God. Jesus rules. His rule reigns. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. What a great way to begin every day. Today, I want your rule to reign in me. Today, verse 10, I want your will to be done right here on earth in my life, just like your will is done with the angels in heaven. That's sincere prayer. Verse 9, let me tell you who you are. Verse 10, let me tell you that I just want to follow you. All right, look at verse 11. Tell me about sincere prayer in verse 11. You guys see any bass boats in verse 11? I don't know, we can debate that as well. But verse 11 is this simple line. What's always impressed me most about this prayer is how much of this prayer is talking to God about physical things. How much of it? One line, right? Give us this day our daily bread. That sort of wraps up the idea of thank you for our family, thank you for our home, thank you for the food on our table. We're thankful for health and life. We can say all those things. But sincerity, I believe in part, is keeping the focus in the right places. This prayer is almost entirely spiritually based. The only exception to that is verse 11. Which means we should be thanking God for our health and our home and our lives and our jobs and our daily bread. There's no doubt about that. But our prayers lose a sense of spiritual integrity when the things in our lives take up so much of our praying that we have very little energy or attention left to address the things that matter most. There are things that matter more than my daily bread. So I'm impressed by the fact that he didn't start with that. He started with, let me tell you who you are, God. He started with, let me tell you what your rule means for me and how important your kingdom is. Then he says, give us this day our daily bread. But what does he say next? What's the meaning of the next phrase? He went immediately back to a spiritual idea. Thank you, God, for putting food on my table. But now let me get back to this. I want you to rule in my life, and unfortunately, that's not happening every day. So, God, I'm asking you to forgive me, and I'm asking for the strength to forgive other people. That's a powerful daily spiritual principle. By the way, I don't contend that these must be recited, the recitation of the Lord's Prayer. I don't think there's a problem with it. Some people go to the other extreme and think that you've done something wrong if you're reciting this prayer. It's an amazing prayer. But I'll tell you this, be careful with verse 12. Forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. Raise your hand if you want that. You want that? Do you want God to forgive you by the same measure that you have been forgiving others? Well, I'll tell you this, that's the idea. The idea is to just forgive because God has forgiven me. But I don't know. Anytime I've tried to pray this, I've always kind of paused a second and said, God, you know what I mean here. You know what I mean? You know that I appreciate this, but I'm not there with this. But for such a simple little prayer, it's got so much dimension to it, but most of it is spiritually focused dimension. God, God's majesty, God's mercy, and extending that mercy. And then verse 13, do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, which has a bracketed section at the end that some manuscripts included, and this version included it. For yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen. I just don't think you can pray that prayer and not be sincere. It demands your sincerity. I mean, verse 12 demands your sincerity. You better be careful with verse 12. It demands that you are thinking the right things and your head is in the right place and you're doing this for the right reasons. This is a great prayer. Sometimes we look at it like SSPS. It's spiritual request, spiritual request, a little physical request, and then right back to spiritual things. Every time I study this, for the next couple of days, I try to make sure that when I talk to God, 75% of what I talk to Him about is about spiritually focused ideas. And about a quarter of it, I'll talk to Him about the things that are going on in the flesh and what they mean to me. So, Jesus is trying to help us make sure that this isn't just about saying some words and it's not about other people. It's about what's right. And this prayer is always going to be the place you'll want to go to sort of give you a reset. I think everybody in this room would do well this week to maybe not recite the prayer, but recite the ideas of the prayer. Grab that principle, reword it, and send it to God. All right, any comments or questions about this prayer and how it helps us be sincere? Okay. So we're sincere in giving to the poor. We're doing it for the right reasons. Our prayer life is sincere. And then he finishes with this, verses 16 through 18. Whenever you fast, do not put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do, for they neglect their appearance so that they will be noticed by men when they are fasting. Truly I say to you, they have their reward in full. But you, when you fast, anoint your head and wash your face so that your fasting will not be noticed by men, but by your Father who is in heaven. And your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And then he goes on to talk about something we'll pick up on in our next class. Fasting. What's the wrong way to fast? Like, we have to think about this, because I don't remember the last time I just went all in on this. But if we were a fasting people, what's the wrong way to do it? Probably like wear a t-shirt that says, I'm fasting. Publicly, okay. Now, to some sense, you will be noticed. Remember, I think we've seen this in all three points. We're not saying you will not be noticed. We aren't saying that there even won't be compliments and accolades for the commitment that you're making, and that's okay. But the purpose is not that. And so you could see these Pharisees, right? They're wearing this ornate gear, and they've been fasting for like 8 minutes. But they just make sure, like, their hair's unkept. They were just too weak to comb their hair. You know, 8 minutes is a long time. And they just want to make sure their face is hardly washed, and they just want you to see that they're going through something. They've given up something. For us, and I'm going to kind of let the cat out of the bag on what I think about 21st century fasting, but I think in some sense it's giving up something so you can fully focus on God. It's saying, I'm not going to escape to that. I'm going to escape to God. But how many people do I want to know about that? Is it about people knowing about what I've given up? I think that was the problem that they were dealing with. So when they fasted, how were they to do so?
Quietly.
Verse 18 says, in secret, at least to the best of your ability. All right. Well, this, I think, brings about a really interesting study. We have about 25 minutes. I've given you a sermon that I put together earlier this year, late last year. And I thought it might be interesting for us to talk about this idea of fasting. Two of these things we know we're supposed to do. Give to the poor, here's how you do it. Praying, here's how you do it, and here's how you don't. What about fasting? Shall we fast? Anybody want to start by answering that? Shall we fast?
Yes.
Anybody? Yes, we shall fast.
Yes.
Should we fast? Oh, I got all kinds of words I can use here. I got a should we. I got a must we. Should we fast? Must we fast? Is it the law of God to fast? What is God's law on this topic? Yes.
I think we have to be careful. In some instances, people's health would be against, it would hurt them to fast in some conditions.
The question, I guess, is twofold. Is it something Christians should be doing? Or is it just something that Jews did in their culture and we should not be doing? And if it's something that we should be doing, the second question is it something that Christians must be doing? Those are the two questions. Wouldn't you say, just about any topic you want to talk about, is this something that's cultural for them and not really something for us, prohibited or not prohibited? And then if it is prohibited, or it's allowed, let's say, then to what extent should I be doing this? Yes.
I think the whole focus is that, you know, it should not be on self. In other words, I'm giving up, say, food for the day or whatever, to know how the misery I'm going through. The focus is God. And so you are focusing on God. And what you are giving up, really, is not that important.
That's the way it's supposed to be. That would be the right way to approach it right there. All right, let me ask it in this way. How many Christian dispensation commands does the Bible contain saying that Christians must fast?
Zero.
All right, that answer is zero. There are zero commands in the New Testament. And by New Testament, I'm talking about the Acts 2 and on, the Christian dispensation. There are zero commands. All right, I knew you were going to say that. But here's the second question. In the Old Testament, not just old law, whole thing, Genesis and the garden and Abraham and his journeys and Egypt and then Moses and the law of Moses and the meticulously detailed law of Moses leading all the way up into Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and covering 4,000 years of human history, how many commands in the Old Testament are there for anyone to fast?
There's a bunch.
More than 20? I gotta be honest, I reevaluated this today. I think the answer might actually be zero. There may not be a single passage ever commanding. Now, there is an exception. I saw some ones out there. I initially came away with one because of Leviticus 16. Look in Leviticus chapter 16. We're going to make a point out of this. We don't have time tonight to look at all the details on this sheet. It's for you and later study if this is something of interest. But notice in Luke 16, it seemed that on this particular day of atonement, that was a very special, unique day once a year in Jewish history. It was sort of a day when God said, the sins have been blanketed and covered, go in peace. In verse 29, this shall be a permanent statute for you in the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall humble your souls and not do any work, whether the native or the alien who sojourns among you, for it is on this day that atonement shall be made for you to cleanse you. You will be clean from all your sins before the Lord. Now, verse 31. It is to be a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, that you may humble your souls. It is a permanent statute. Now, that doesn't say anything about fasting, but some versions do. Some versions interpret that phrase, I forget the exact wording there, is related to fasting. And it may be that one day a year, one single day, not 40 days and 40 nights, one day, that they would not eat of food as a law of God. I found that really interesting. I studied this for the first time this last year, and I put down every single fasting verse I could find, Genesis through Revelation, and found maybe zero commands. They did it because it could be a good thing and a needful thing for some, but not as an ordinance of righteousness to God. Yes, sir?
How do we define fasting? Exactly what is it? To me, it's giving up something. So if you have something that's hindering you, then you need to fast.
All right, let's walk into that slowly. I want to walk into that slowly. I want to say this. Biblically speaking, I believe every time fasting is used, it is an intentional abstinence from food. It's not that the food is evil and you have to give it up. It's that for this purpose, on this occasion, we're going to not eat and focus on something else. So while I agree with you, we're going to kind of extrapolate some applications at the end of this study. All of what you're looking at, see the seven things on the sheet? Whenever they wanted to appeal to the mercy of God and focus on that and that only, they abstained perhaps from food the entire day. In Deuteronomy 9, in days where Moses was seeking God's mercy in hopes that God would hear, Moses fasted for 40 days. Incredible. I actually know a guy who tried to go 30 days. After about 25 days, he was like walking around into walls and stuff, and his wife told him to eat. Really, I mean, he was having trouble processing, no inputs. 40 days, Moses fasted. Here's another thing I found really interesting. There aren't a lot of marathon fastings in the Bible. That one comes to mind, Moses, 40 days, because he wanted to make sure that his mind was on nothing else. It was absolutely sort of taken away from any other sort of feeding, and it was fully on God. Can you think of any other really long ones? Matthew 4 and Jesus. And that is about it. This idea that fasting is this several week long expedition is unique biblically to only two, maybe three people. Number three, in days of imminent war, when they were frightened about the potential of battle, they fasted for about a half a day. It said they fasted until evening. So maybe they skipped two meals. In 2 Samuel 7, when David was suffering, his baby had been born, he was sick, he fasted for 7 days, and then the baby died. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, they fasted until evening, so less than a day. Nehemiah, number 6, in times of stress and disappointment, fasted for days, doesn't say how long. And Esther, in the book of Esther, they fasted for 3 days. So the lengths are half a day, 3 days, a week. The length is not something that's mandated by God. That's our first point. And nowhere did God say, you must fast for this long. But what I noticed that's common here, look down below that at a little list. A couple things we notice. Firstly, fasting was a regular part of the lives of Israelites. Not a command, but something that many of them did. Number two, it seemed to be something that was done in days of great emotional intensity. Severely needing the mercy of God right now. Fully hoping that He will atone us. Battle is imminent. Children are sick. Things are heavy. It seems like in times like that they fasted. Thirdly, prayer and fasting seem to go hand in hand. It's almost as if, to oversimplify it a bit, instead of feasting on food, you're feasting on God. Instead of interacting with what's on the plate, which we know can sometimes be a nice little escape, sometimes all our focus goes there, we forget about everything else going on. Instead of that, I'm going to enter into a feast with God. and I will talk to him and I will listen to him. So prayer was a connected part. And then fourthly, it seemed to be about focusing on God, removing, and this is where John was going a bit ago, removing any kind of distractions, any kind of endeavors, just God. Now this is where it begins to hit me. I don't know about you. I may need to do some fasting. If fasting is something done in times of emotional intensity, that happens. If it's a time when I need some seriously focused prayer life, those days happen. And if it helps me forget everything else and just engage upon God, I'm pretty sure I need that. So fasting by the end of this study may be something that we joyfully and willfully endeavor upon. All right, so before we get to the Gospels, that's where we're going next. Just based on what you've seen in Old Testament fasting, do you have any comments or questions? Anything about that? Anybody else surprised at the lack of commands? That was a surprise to me. Yes?
One thing is, you know that every meal comes from God, and by doing it without, it kind of helps you recognize where this is going to be in time.
Sometimes we feast on the blessings and we forget about the giver of the blessings. And so it helps us remember that. Yes, sir?
As far as it being a command, this is something that comes from your heart. This is something that you do. It's not something God forces you to do. If he had a law that required you to do it, if he forced you to do it, it would be of no value to you. But it is something that you willingly do in order to draw closer to him.
To some extent, I agree with where you're going with that. My answer might be prayer is commanded. The Bible doesn't say fast without ceasing. Everybody says amen. But the Bible does say to pray without ceasing. We're instructed to pray. These two things are different. It doesn't mean that prayer is of no value because we're commanded to do it, but I also understand your point. What fasting becomes is a willful decision to say, today, not this, but this. I'm not talking about giving up sinful things. Today, I'm going to put aside this terrible sinful thing and I'm going to focus on God. No. Today, I'm going to take good things God has put in my life that I want to feast upon. Today, it's not about that. And here's the thing. You guys have heard of things like escapism. You're depressed. You're upset. You're sick. You're hurting. Life's rough. Going through a tough patch. What do we do? What do people in our culture do to cope with times like that? They binge on something. You eat. Nervous eating. Anyone? It's sinful things sometimes. It's alcohol. It's immorality. Okay, that's there. But even without that, it's still stuff. We go, we buy something. Or we go and we play and we play and we play. Or we eat and we eat and we eat. This is where we're going with this, is this idea that God's people wanted to make it all about God. So let's move forward. Let's go to the Gospels. Go to Matthew 4. We're already kind of studying in Matthew. I want you to see fasting now just in the Gospels, and this won't take long to examine. The first one you already noted, and that's in Matthew chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. This is something that Jesus did. Jesus fasted in connection with time alone with God. Matthew chapter 4, verse 1, Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. After he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, then he became hungry. We don't know why, but he saw it as something that would increase his focus. There's something to be said for Jesus the Christ doing something so that he can fully give his attention to God. That something is instantly an important something. And he chose to fast for a long period of time. Later in Matthew 6, and this is our study, in Matthew chapter 6, verses 16 through 18, Jesus simply taught about how to do it. He didn't command to do it. He didn't say it would die with the old law. He just said, when you do it, make sure it's sincere. That's our study. It is personal. It is an appeal of focus upon and reliance upon God. Now, let me ask you this before we get to Matthew 9. You might already know this. Is it always appropriate to fast? What would you say to that? Even though it's an option, is it always an appropriate thing to do? It's not. Jesus taught that it might not always be the right thing to do at the right moment. What am I talking about in Matthew chapter 9? For he was asked about it. Do you guys remember what he said in Matthew chapter 9?
He was asked why his disciples weren't fasting. And his answer in short is, I'm here. Why would they be sad?
All right. Fasting largely, when you get into the Gospels, has to do with times of emotional distress. You're really upset. You're hurting. You need God. By choice, then, you might set aside a time and just sit and think about Him and skip a meal and not dive into those things. So they're coming to Jesus saying, we are John's disciples and we're fasting, and your disciples aren't fasting. Explain that to me. Now, let me just ask you, what might be happening to John at this moment? He's probably in prison by Matthew chapter 9. It is perhaps possible, I couldn't really get exactly where I wanted to be on knowing the answer to this. He might even be dead. He is detained and he is near death, and his disciples are frantic about that. And so in Matthew chapter 9, verse 14, the disciples of John came to Jesus asking, why do we and the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast? And Jesus said to them, the attendants of the bridegroom cannot mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them, can they? But the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. But no one puts a patch on unshrunk cloth or on an old garment, for the patch pulls away from the garment and a worse tear results. Nor do people put new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wineskins burst, the wine pours out, and the wineskins are ruined. But they put new wine in fresh wineskins and both are preserved. I have a sermon on this I might preach coming up. The wineskins and the patches. And you ask somebody, what do the two illustrations of the wineskins and the patches mean? And they're like, ooh, check this out. You know, it's old law, new law, old law, matching, and how the twist. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about him giving two examples to prove that some things just don't fit together. I just preached a 42-minute sermon in 30 seconds. Some things just don't fit. You try to put them together, it's going to rip apart. What doesn't fit in this text? What's the old patch and the new garment? One is what?
Fasting.
I'm fasting while what? While we're rejoicing. I'm fasting. I'm going through this sort of sober, I just have to have you, God, because there's just, I don't know where else to turn, and I don't know what to do, and I need help. When Jesus is going, I'm right here. I'm working miracles. This is as good as it's ever going to get. And so fasting is not something that, this eliminates some things. Fasting is not something you do to show that you're a great Christian. Can I just pause for dramatic effect right there? It's not something you do to show, ooh, I'm a really, really solid, sacrificial Christian, so I'm not going to eat for 10 days. I didn't mean to tell you that, but it's 10 days, but I didn't mean to tell you that. Not only is it not about what people know, it's not about you being super great or disciplined or given. Look, I think there's room for all that, but that's not what fasting was. Fasting is, life is really weighty and I need God and I don't want to run to anything. I don't want to run to watch another Astros game. I don't want to run to cake. I don't want to run to my cell phone. I don't want to run out on the golf course. I don't want to run any of that stuff. All that stuff will give me little temporary fixes. I need to go to somebody who really fixes this. I need help. Fasting is setting aside that time so that you can get that help. Which means you may not have to do it, but it also means you may have to do it. Does that make sense? You may not have to. Some people are so well self-disciplined, they can shut everything else off and just go to God in prayer. We sing the song, when's the last time you spent the night in prayer? How many of us have ever done that? Some of us can do that. Others of us have to turn things off, put things away, write things off, close things down, just read and talk. So maybe we do. All right, so there's what we have in this text. I'm looking at the Gospels. Jesus did it. Jesus taught that it could be done personally in the right way. He taught that it needs to be done for appropriate reasons. It's not a religious rite. It's not about losing weight. It's not about being a disciple. And number four, Jesus combines, as would be an obvious case here, he combines powers of prayer and fasting. In Matthew 17, also I'm sure in Matthew 4 in the wilderness, you're naturally going to pray if you know what this is about. If I'm just skipping some meals and I'm saying that I'm fasting for God, you're not fasting. Fasting and prayer work in perfect unison, and really I don't think you can have fasting without prayer. I just think that they work together too closely. All right, so before we go to the next page, any comments or questions about fasting up to the life of Jesus? All right, take a look at the second page. Question then. Isn't that all still Law of Moses stuff? Well, technically, yes. Everything up until the book of Acts, even Jesus and all the stuff that he taught, technically was monitoring and regulating and instructing Jews who lived under the law. So a question that I had was, what about after the new law was established? Did fasting continue in the lives of Christians in the Christian dispensation? What's the answer? Yes. Yes, they did. Let's take a look at those briefly. Acts chapter 13 will help us. Look in Acts the 13th chapter. By the time you get to Acts chapter 13 and you're in Antioch, you may even have more than just Jews involved by this point. You may be looking at Jewish people who are no longer under the law of Moses but still sort of culturally attached to it, but you may also have Gentiles as well. And in verse 1 of Acts 13, now there were at Antioch in the church that was there prophets and teachers. They list all these, Barnabas and Saul, etc. While they were ministering to the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, set apart for me Barnabas and Saul for the work to which I have called them. Then, when they had fasted and prayed and laid their hands on them, they sent them away. All right, let me ask a question of you. Kind of seemed like fasting is times of sorrow and burden and distress, and a lot of times it was. But what is the fasting about by Christians here? Why are they doing it here? Looked like they were doing it before they knew what they were about to do, and then after they knew what they were about to do. What's the deal?
I think that they were really seeking God's help in a journey that was going to be difficult.
Seeking God's help in a journey that was going to be difficult. Was it difficult, the first missionary journey? Yeah, it was really, really difficult. In fact, one guy just gave up halfway and said, I'm going home. It was really, really challenging, Acts chapter 13 and 14, and Paul and Barnabas and John Mark's first missionary journey. So they are fasting. What's interesting to me is, while they were ministering to the Lord and fasting, the Holy Spirit said, pick these two guys and send them away, and they kept fasting. They were doing it even before the mission was really specified. So what's this about? You want to add to her comments? It's not just about when bad things are happening, is it? What's it about?
Time of great decision.
Okay, time of great decision. Good.
Focusing on the work.
Yeah. It's just weightiness, you know? It's just weighty, tough times. They were, at the very beginning of the church, there was incredible opposition, and they wanted to be diligent in the work. And so they're fasting sort of to just continually talk to God about our work. We want to focus on the ministry. And they were, it says they were ministering to the Lord and fasting. Those two things are going together. God, it's not just prayer. We're not even going to eat right now. We just want to teach and sing and pray and serve. And then when they found out that two of them were going on a mission, they all fasted. So a couple things really stand out here on your sheet. They fasted as they did the Lord's work. It seems it was this mental exercise. And it also seems like they did it collectively. You ever heard of such a thing? You ever heard of like a whole church fasting for a day? I don't think I have. That's interesting that you have. I think probably we need to see something like that. We need to see something that says, today it's not going to be about any of that stuff that we don't need, that we think we need. Today, we have a big thing about to happen. We've got a major change. We have a huge mission. We have an open door for service. And that's where we want to put our attention. Not a command, but something we want to do together. Yes?
I would think that our brethren who are serving in really difficult places where they have to hide and where they can't assemble where anybody knows other than a handful of people would utilize this tool to really focus on their safety, allowing God to provide a way for them to spread the word.
Yeah, really intense places in the world. You know, it is a reminder that our situation and theirs is very different, isn't it, in terms of the weight of it. Jonathan?
Our wills are strong, and we don't necessarily know how strong they are until they're tested. And this is an opportunity to test your will. To go without eating, if you haven't gone without eating before, it can challenge your will. You know, to do something that you have done your whole entire life, three times a day, for some of us, a lot more than that, and it's obvious. But, it's just something that we do. It's part of our everyday life. It's part of us socially. It is something that we just do, and our bodies on a regular clock says, okay, it's time to eat. And now I am telling my body, no, I'm not doing it. And I am suppressing my will and saying, no, that's not going to happen. Not my will be done. And I'm focusing on somebody else's will. And to do that can be really challenging, because there are things that go through your mind and you're saying, it's not that big of a deal if I eat just a little bit. It's not that big of a deal if I look at my phone just one time, because I want to give up my phone. If it's not that big of a deal if I want to do these things. But I think for the Christians here, it was important to understand, not my will be done, but look how important God's will is at this point in time. And I want to put all my focus on that and suppress all of these physical and fleshly desires that I have, and focus solely on this one spiritual thing, or these several spiritual things.
And Jonathan's really onto something in terms of first century society. Meals was it. It was the thing. I mean, now we still treasure that, but we have a lot of other things that we do with easy accessibility as well. All right, there's one other passage, Acts 14. You can look at that later. It's really similar. Christians fasted together in selecting new elders. Big decision. Contemplating spiritual things. Put those other things aside. So four deals here to look at. Firstly, this still does not necessitate a command, not individually or collectively. Secondly, however, giving up lawful things to simply engross oneself in spiritual things is a practice that Christians did. Thirdly, in times of great weight and importance, sometimes even a whole group of people did it. And fourthly, this idea seems to extend to fasting in other areas besides food. Jonathan, in his comments, mentioned the phone or something like that. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, they gave up marital relations. They gave up sex for a time just so they could pray. They gave up something that was lawful, something that was good, something that would draw a lot of their attention, their focus, you notice, just like food. They said, we're going to step aside from that for a while. I'm just going to pray. But he said, you need to come back together lest you neglect what God wants you to do. So here's what I need you to do. Our time's just about up. Just take a look at the rest of this. Maybe we need this. Now, be careful not to pick some huge thing that you can't fulfill to God. Remember, only like two of the cases in the Bible was it 30 or 40 days. It may be a half a day. Or one night, or every night this week, we're not going to watch television, we're going to do this instead, or something like that. But it's about saying, I have all these things I typically escape to, lawful things, but that's where I run when I'm stressed out. I think I'm going to set aside a little time and not run to those things this week. Not tonight. Not this time. And instead, I want to give that attention over to God, and maybe those things will start to grow. I've got some comments there at the end. That I encourage you to check out. If you have any questions about this, we can talk about it later.